The following presentation was recorded at a Christian Light Education workshop. More information at clp.org.
I prefer about enough water that I can take a shower. I'm not a fish. I enjoy fishing. But I don't have a lot of extreme water attraction. Yet I found something very, very interesting. And that is the extremely creative and interesting things that God has done with the ocean. It's absolutely fascinating. Recently I read that some scientists made this comment that the man knows more about Mars and the moon than what they know about the ocean. Are you looking here for handouts?
Yes.
Okay, here's a bunch. And I have a rather long extended handout. I'm not going to be able to go through all of it. I try to follow it somewhat sequential so you don't have to jump around too much. We could write and complete encyclopedia sets about this subject. The little bit of time that I did spend looking at it for this and other times, if you go to the public library, you can get some nice big books about the ocean, and there is just fascinating information there, pictures and so on. Just it'll give you hours and hours of reading and looking enjoyment, really. And although much of it has been written from an ungodly perspective, I mean without acknowledging God, you see the design, the beauty, the creativity, the wonder that God has displayed in what happens below the surface of the waters. One of the earliest Bible verses I learned as a boy that I can recall is out of Psalm 107, verse 23 and 24. They that go down to the sea in great waters, these that do business in great waters, these see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. And if God in his word already said at that time that the mariners and the sailors and the so on saw the wonders of God in the deep, how much more do we have opportunity today with a lot of the technology and information that we have present over what was available at that time? I'd like to do just a brief rundown. The Bible gives a lot of information, shows a lot of interest that God places in water. Of course, he made it. The intriguing thing is, the Bible says that on the heavens, God made the heaven and the earth, and in the beginning, his spirit floated upon the water. You know, how was this water made? When was it made? I guess those are some of the questions that we can wait till heaven to ask God. There was a time when the entire globe was covered with water in the flood, and the physical and spiritual significance that has for us even today. The Bible speaks about he controls the boundaries of the water and so on. And there's much about the water that is not known, the ocean. The Hebrew people spoke a lot about the Old Testament and even in the New of the significance of the Red Sea occurrence and the children of Israel walking through there and then later on into the land of Canaan across the Jordan. And both the spiritual and the physical significances of those occurrences. We read about Jonah and his, successful submarine experience. We read of Christ stilling the storm and the miraculous draughts of fishes and walking on the water. The Bible talks about different sea animals, the Leviathan. I guess there's still somewhat question, what is that, or what was that kind of an animal, sea creature? The Bible speaks at one time when there will be no more sea, and that is at the end of time. And so the Bible has a lot of information, gives us a lot of interest, of God's interest in this whole wonders of the deep, and how God works in that. Now, if we go to the more science significance and work of oceanography, I'd like to look at just four areas briefly. The physical oceanography, which talks about how water moves, basically. The chemical oceanography, how seawater, its composition. Marine geology, the landforms and shapes of things underwater. And marine biology, which is the plant and animal life that is in the water. Before we do that, just some interesting details, though, about the oceans. There is on this globe really one ocean. We say there are five. And we'll look at them briefly, but before we do that even, the oceans cover about 71% of our globe. And if you would take all the water, ocean waters together that we have, that's about 97% of all the water that we do have in the world today is ocean water. And about 80% of the southern hemisphere is ocean, 60% of the northern. And as I said, there's five oceans, the largest being the Pacific, which is one-third of the planet, the Atlantic, the Indian, and then the Southern Ocean. Now, that may be a new term for some. Probably many of you would have in school learned of that as the Antarctic Ocean. But since about the year 2000, the name was changed to Southern officially. I think also the boundaries of the ocean were changed at that point too, somewhat. Of course, the Southern Ocean is that which surrounds the continent of Antarctica. And the smallest ocean is the Arctic Ocean, which is the area, the waters around the North Pole. Ocean depths, of course, vary. The average depth of the ocean is about 13,000 feet, 2.5 miles. Of water. The deepest part of the ocean known is the Mariana Trench near Guam, an island in the Pacific, where we have depths of 35,840 feet. Well, that's about 7.5 miles. If you take Mount Everest and would plant it at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, you'd still have 1.3 mile of water above Mount Everest covering it. So, it is deep. It is extremely deep. Of course, the ocean water's temperatures vary. At the poles, it's around the freezing mark. And at the equators, you'll have waters that are around the 85 degree Celsius mark, possibly. And the poles and equator that determines some of that, as well as ocean currents. We'll look at some of that here just briefly. Going over to physical circulation, physical movements, physical oceanography, we have, first of all, circulation of the ocean, which is basically currents, and then we have waves, and we have tides. Going, first of all, to currents of the ocean. There's about 19 major ocean current that we know of, or that have been labeled. Let's see if we can get this situated right here. This shows 19 of them. There are at least several more, but this is them. The blue ones are cold current. The red ones are warm. And obviously, the blue ones seem to be more on the poles, and the warm one is closer to the equator. And really, an ocean current is a river of water within the ocean. It's a certain pathway of water moving in a certain direction. And this river of ocean water can be of a salinity and of a temperature that varies with the rest of the water around it. Now, ocean currents are affected, their movements are affected by the rotation of the earth. They are affected by this winds as well as the heat of the sun. And obviously, these ocean currents will make a difference of the climates and the temperatures of the land, of the continents near where they are. There's really two kinds of ocean currents or currenting they'd like to look at. The one is the ocean currents that are near the top, which we call wind-driven currents. These are affected by the wind above the water, the upper 300 to 600 feet of water. And we can go into a lot of details, which I won't. But these lines that you see here are basically ocean currents, the wind-driven currents in the top 600 feet of water. And they are wind systems that tend to move in an east-west pattern. You can see that. In the northern hemisphere, they go in a clockwise rotation. In the southern hemisphere, counterclockwise. And the continents somehow keep these ocean currents somewhat in their separate oceans to some degree. That's the wind-driven currents. Then there is another movement of water, which we call the thermohaline circulation. Again, this is the best picture I could find this way. What we have here, of course, is the continents. And this is the water which is below the 600 level mark. And it works somewhat like a conveyor belt that's slanted, sloped, but moving in a certain direction. And what it is, it's really water that is moving from down, up, and up, like a conveyor will do that. But at the same time, this conveyor belt is moving, progressing a certain place. And this, too, is like a river of water going a certain way. And since colder water, saltier water, is heavier, it's at the bottom. But this conveyor belt system has it moving up. It's estimated, and scientists have done calculation, that it can take up to 600 years for a drop of water from the bottom of the ocean to get to the top in this conveyor belt movement. It can take a drop of water about 1,000 years to make its way all through this system around the globe, and finally reach its, what we might want to call its originating point. How they've calculated this, I have no idea. So we live on a globe that is in constant motion. Not only do we rotate and turn around its axis and around the sun, these kind of things, but even the water in which we are situated, a good part of it, is also in a moving effect on a constant way. That's a circulation. Then we have waves. Now, waves are the top of the water that's affected by the wind moving it along, disturbing it. Actually, the waves don't travel. The waves are a bit like if you would take a rope and tie this to a doorknob over there, and then you would yank the rope in an up and jerk it in an up and down position. It moves up and down, but it's not moving forward anyway. That's a bit how waves operate. However, as waves come toward land, they tend to slow down, and then the wave strength size tends to increase because their dragging becomes steeper. Now, wave sizes also vary due to how long their span has been on the ocean surface, how fast the wind speed is, how far they've blown, and how deep the shelf or the water is at the point at which they reach land. Or the continental shelf, we could say, at what depth that will have. So we have circulation, we have waves, and then we also have tides. Now, I should say this before we go to tides, and that's on tsunamis. Tsunamis are basically waves that, however, were created from bottom water, not from top surface water. If there is an earthquake or a volcanic eruption or a landslide on the ocean floor or down toward the bottom of the ocean, that can create a serious movement of water, wave water that will affect the top as well. And as I said before, as this water moves toward the land, it tends to drag, it tends to slow down. And so what you have is you have one wave coming, and it's slowing down. And upon that, there's another wave coming, and it's slowing down. Another wave coming, and it's slowing down. See, of course, in the water level, the wave just rises. The wave wall rises. And you can have these tsunami waves crashing onto land at speeds of about 600 mile an hour. Some of us will remember some of the tsunami incidents in the Indonesia area a number of years ago. Going over to tides. Tides is the rise and fall of the surface water of the ocean. And it's done based on the gravitational effect that the moon and also the sun have on the earth. More the moon than the sun. I like this picture, but it's dark, unfortunately. There's two kinds of tides. High tide and low tide, and we're not talking about that. But depending on the location of Earth, Moon, and Sun at any particular time. Here we have the Sun, the Earth, and the Moon in full moon or new moon positions. When that happens, the Sun, Earth, and Moon are in a line. When you have that happen, you also have a bulging effect of gravitation here on the one side of the Earth where the moon is at, here at the full moon, here at the new moon. And that bulging effect, gravitational effect, causes during those times of the month that the tides rise higher and fall greater. We call this a spring tide. A neap tide happens during first or third quarter of the moon when the sun and earth and the moon are in a right angle position to each other. That the moon is at a right angle toward the earth in its line with the sun. When that happens, the gravitational effect is much less. There's much less of a bulge. The bulge is over here instead of in the direct line. And then the tides are not near as distinct, not near as they don't rise as high or fall as great at that time either. Tides, of course, affect the level of water on the ocean as it reach at land point on a daily basis in most cases. The greatest tide that is known to us, that man has been able to find and knows about on the earth, is the Bay of Fundy, which is in Nova Scotia. Some of you may have had opportunity to see those. I've seen them in pictures only, where the greatest tide rise and fall is about 53 feet. And so that I've seen a picture of it. You can be standing on this rock looking down, and there's just a long way of nothing. And there's trees growing on this rock. And if you would come X number of hours later, you would be standing next to water because the tide would have risen that much in those number of hours. That's the Bay of Fundy. And it is the moon's effect particularly, but in its relation to the sun and the earth. Let's just, before we finish with this whole circulation, physical oceanography, we'll go a little bit back to currents. One of the things that in the last number of years has been in the news, in the newspapers and so a lot more is the effects of El Niño and La Niña. El Niño and La Niña are ocean current patterns in the Pacific Ocean. El Niño is a warm ocean pattern it's a disturbance, disruption of the water and the atmosphere. And as this moves toward the western coasts of Canada, the United States, Mexico, it creates a warmer climate, a warmer weather effect on our continent here, of North America. The La Niña effect is the opposite. It is a colder current disturbance and disruption, and then provides colder temperatures than normal to the North American continent as well. Of course, hurricanes are another weather pattern. I guess here you may feel the distant effect of some hurricanes, don't you, in this part of America? And hurricanes always happen in tropical water. That's where they originate. When you have a warm ocean surface and you have a high humidity atmosphere and you have a wind force that starts circulating wind in a certain pattern, spiraling it, and then, of course, this then moves toward land. Of course, we know the effects of that. It brings can bring a lot of damage, and rain and wet kind of weather. Definitely to the land area closest to the ocean, it can be rather severe. Okay, we don't have a lot of time, so we better move on. The chemical part. Chemical oceanography deals with the composition of water. If we would look at a graph, circular graph, all these different elements are found. this amount of each element is found in a cubic mile of water, starting with oxygen, hydrogen, and all the way down. If you'd be a gold miner and you're looking for gold in a cubic mile of water, you'll probably find about 38 pounds of it. So you'll have to work pretty hard for gold at that spot. Of course, what we know ocean water to be like, it's salty. About 3.5% of it. If we would take all the ocean water and evaporate the water out of the salt, there'd be enough salt, it's claimed, to cover all of the seven continents with about over 400 feet of salt. So we have a lot of salty water around us, we do. And actually very little fresh water that is available to us presently. Moving on to marine geology. We could spend a lot of time on each of these subjects, and we can't do that. God has made it so amazing that man can survive with so much salty water around us, and which we cannot effectively use the way it is, and yet God has provided enough for us. Yet there's all these sea creatures that live in the salty water, and they have special glands with how to get rid of the excess salt that they have. But going over to marine geology then. If you would take a map, and I don't have one with me here, of the oceans, you would find that it has all kinds of features similar to what we have on the continents. But before we look at them, I would like to look at what are some of these geological, not what they are, but what happens there. If we would take the different parts of landforms in the ocean, here at the top, and I'm going from in a horizontal position here, movement here, we have, first of all, the intertidal zone. This is the difference, what we would basically call the beach area, between high tide and low tide. So that, depending on how much the tide falls at any place. That's a very small zone of land. And that intertidal zone varies. There's 275,000 miles of sea coast, ocean coast, on the continents of the world. And they vary. Some of it is sandy beach. Other of it is rocky shore. There can be bays. There can be gulfs and seas and fjords. There can be deltas and marshes and harbors and all these things. They make up these 275,000 feet. And a lot of that is in the intertidal zone and also in the next zone, which we know here, this area here, as the continental shelf. This is a gentle sloping, declining shelf of water, of land underwater. At places it may be 19 miles, others it can be almost up to 200 miles in length, in its width, away from the land. This is, of course, where all the river water, the fresh waters flow in and join ocean water. In fact, I believe it is, there's so much fresh water that pours in from the Amazon River in Brazil into the, where it meets the ocean, or it meets the Atlantic, that there is a significant area of Atlantic Ocean water which has very little salt in it. there's so much water, fresh water moving into the ocean at that point. But here on that continental shelf is where you have probably the greatest amount of life forms, either plant or animal, that we find in the ocean waters. This is also where river sediments and pollution and all that stuff from land comes. And then from there it moves to this deeper slope, this steeper slope, which we call the continental slope. This is a steeper slope of land moving down. Geologists and scientists consider this slope of land to actually be the foundation, the underwater foundation of each continent, the sidewall, so to speak, of each continent under the waters. And again, the width of this varies from can be 12 to 60 miles. At the bottom of this continental slope, you will have a continental rise. And this is where all this river sediment and whatever that comes tumbling down this slope, it tends to gather at the bottom there and have somewhat of a rise there. Varies too as to how big that is. And from there on, you then have the ocean floor, the ocean basin. And if you would look on a map of the ocean basin, which is about half of the globe, is ocean basin, you would see landforms like sea mounts, ridges, which are chains of mountains. You would see volcanoes and volcanic cones. You would see plains, you would see basins, you would see trenches, you would see valleys. You would see all these landforms, just like what we are used to seeing on a continent as well. Jumping over quickly yet to marine biology, which intrigues probably most of us the most because of the wonderful things that God has made. If we look at this same chart that we have here, but we look at it from a vertical position, we have here the top 600 feet of water. We consider that the sunlit zone. This is water that is affected by the sunlight, and it is in this area of water where you will find most of the plant and animal life existing because of its relation, its connection to the sun. Below that, up to the 3,000-foot mark, you have the twilight zone, and below that we have the midnight zone. And the midnight zone, it is just permanently dark. The only natural light that you will find in the midnight zone is biofluorescence or bioluminescent light. There are plants and animals that God has designed that can create, that biologically manufacture light in their body systems. But their light has no effect, or it's not done with a heat effect. Any light that we know always has a relationship to heat. For example, this light here, it's warm. It has a heat effect. Bioluminescence, biofluorescence doesn't have that. Like I said, scientists are finding interesting things constantly. Just recently, my wife found this about a glowing turtle. There is it's called the hawksbill sea turtle. It's a critically endangered sea turtle. Has amazing ability that they have not seen in any other reptile. They have seen it in other organisms, but not in reptiles. But this hawksbill sea turtle, if you would expose it to blue light, its shell will glow neon green and red. That means it can take light of one color into its body and emit it into a different color. There are other organisms that can do the same. It's called biofluorescence. But this time, it's the first time that they've seen a reptile, a sea reptile, able to do this. And they somehow discovered this, how should I say, by accident. It was somewhat, it was not something that they were particularly looking for. And all of a sudden, they saw a sea turtle do this. Okay, let's look quickly at, for a few minutes, at marine biology. Of course, there's two kinds of plant, there's two kinds of life. There's plant life and there's animal life. And we'll look at the three kinds of things that are down there. The first is plankton. There's two types of plankton. There's plant plankton and animal plankton. Now, plant plankton is called phytoplankton. Animal plankton is called zooplankton. And plankton is really tiny, some of it, many of it, single-celled organisms. And what defines plankton is that they are, that they just, they float on the water. They are at the mercy of water movement. They can't swim, anything like that. They just, however water moves, that's where they are. And some of them are single-celled, others, of course, are multi-celled. The plant plankton, much of it that we know of, is called algae. And this forms the basis of the food chain, which other animals then live off of. Algae is classified according to its color. The greatest amount of algae known in the world today is yellow algae. Then there's red and there's brown and there's green. And algae is not used only as animal food, as fish animal food, sea animals. Man harvests it as well. Any of you had mayonnaise recently? Algae is in there. Ice cream likely has algae in it. It's used as in food and food additives or food thickeners. It's used to bind paint colors. It's used in inks. It's used in explosives. It's used in it's harvested for different products that man makes. Of course, its biggest significance in the world is that it feeds other plant and animal other animal life. The zooplankton, of course, are these small animal creatures, some of them very, very tiny, microscopic, and some of these zooplankton, as they grow, actually become the last category we'll look at, and that's the benthos. If they aren't eaten or swallowed up in some way by some other plant, they have the opportunity, by some other animal, I should say, they have the opportunity to grow. They actually become a different, not so much a different form, but they go into a different category. Let's look, we had plankton, let's go over to nekton. The nekton are the free swimmers. And so these are animals that can actually determine their own movement within the water. That includes all forms of fish, squid, sea animal, octopus, sea mammals, I should say, octopus, all these creatures that move on their own. We could spend hours talking about all these different creatures We don't have time for that. Shell-less creatures like octopus. Intriguing creatures, although they look ugly. I think they do. I did find a picture of a... Here. Hopefully you can see that. That's the giant octopus. 16 feet. Yet it is amazing through what a very small kind of area that octopus would be able to get through. For example, if we would take this octopus and put it into a large aquarium, and we're going to keep this animal in there, and we'd want to cover it, we'd have to make sure that that cover is pretty, pretty tight. Because it can slide through very, very, very small kind of a crack. Because it's totally flexible, this creature. And it's able to, it can make itself, it can change into any shape basically that it wants to get where it wants to go. Octopus have three hearts, have blue blood. There's about 289 kinds of them. They can alter their body forms. They can camouflage themselves. They can spit out a sepia. It's like a black ink-like pigment to defend themselves. Some of them actually are poisonous and have a sting. There's squid. Let's move over quickly to fish. There's more than 20,000 kinds of fish, from half-inch size to 40-foot size. They're classified according to whether they're jawless or jawed. There's all kinds. Again, we can't take time for that. There's so many, many, many of them. And then there's aquatic mammals like whales and sea cows and dugongs and all these other kinds of creatures. I wish we had time to show you. I wish I had pictures here that would be meaningful enough to see about these creatures. Let's go quickly yet to benthos. Benthos are those sea creatures, plants and animals, that are stationary, but they live on the ocean floor or at the bottom of a continental shelf. They don't tend to move. We would talk of these as seashell creatures. Creatures like lobster, crayfish, shrimp, oyster, clam, mussel, snails, starfish, all these kinds of creatures, they tend to be more stationary. And yet they make up a significant part of the food chain for larger animals as well. Just a few moments yet on the coral reef. I don't know how many of you do diving like that, have been down to the Caribbean, had an opportunity to see coral reefs there, or over to Australia, north of Australia, to see the Great Barrier Reefs that are there. I have not, but there's incredible beauty down there. Most of the reefs are formed above volcanic cones, and really they are millions of tiny sea creatures, some of them very small, that have banded together and formed a living organism that has secreted somewhat of a resin, a surface over itself, and they've just stuck themselves together and catch whatever food the ocean waters bring their way. And there is an incredible beauty that you will find there among these coral reefs that are there. There's different types of coral reefs. I have it explained there just briefly. You can have all kinds of sea animals in a coral reef, more than 500 species may be present, that have fixed themselves together this way. The Great Coral Reef, which is the biggest one north of Australia, is about 1,420 miles in length. It's the largest biological construction on the planet Earth. In fact, scientists, as they look from space, it's the only biological thing that they can see on the planet. They can see this reef there. It attracts a lot of wildlife, both in the water and the water above it. Turtles and fish, birds, and so on, because it has various lagoons that are shallow as well as deep among these reefs. Okay, just a few moments yet. Is the ocean significant to us? We as a land-loving people, and most of us live in areas where we don't have close access to huge bodies of water, sometimes forget the significance that these oceans bring to us, the importance that they have. Oceans moderate our climates. Oceans regulate them, the weather patterns. Oceans provide a significant part of our food. Oxygen, precipitation, fuel, fossil fuels like gas and petroleum, natural gas. It's brought up from the ocean floors beneath that. A lot of minerals, medicines, these type of things originate from the ocean. And then there's the whole, for God's people, the whole wonder of the Creator, that of what God has made down there. Sometimes I guess I'd like to ask God, why did you make so much that we can't see and just be amazed about? But I guess that's just the beauty and the character of God, to do a lot of things, and create a lot of things that few of us really get, how should I say, top enjoyment out of. It is again, just if you want your children, your students, to see the wow of God, get a hold of some ocean material. It's just fascinating to look through these books and just see what God has designed. Creatures that are, in our experience, extremely unusual, but gorgeous, beautiful, fascinating in what they do, and so on. Okay, it is time to close.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.